Welcome back. I'm Hannah Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the recently released collection of stories, Love Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women, 25 women share their reflections on reconciling who they are with where they've come from. They're all women, and they're all Muslim, but the stories have a wider resonance for all those who've had to make decisions between personal identity and community, between acceptance and modern American society and acceptance in the tradition of one's roots. One contributor, Tolu Adiba, writes, "I fear being forced to choose between two integral components of my identity, my faith and my sexuality." Love Inshallah acknowledges the complexities and tensions inherent in immigrant families and communities, and it gives a voice to those coming of age and searching for self-discovery among traditional or orthodox religious groups in the context of secular American society. So, from Islam to Catholicism to Orthodox Judaism, even to the U.S. military, our question today is, how difficult is it to claim your sexuality or your personal identity within strict and traditional institutions? What's your story? Joining us today are Aisha Matu. She's the co-editor of Love Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women, and Zahra Noorbakhsh, contributor to the book. And thank you both for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
And we want to hear from you as well. Give us a call at 866-798-TALK, 866-798-TALK, or drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org to tell us about your experiences, or if you have a question or comment for our guests today. Or better yet, you can post a web comment at yourcallradio.org. So let's get started, Aisha. What led to you and your co-author, Noora Masnavi, to this book project? What was the idea? What was the need?
About 5 years ago, Noora and I were sitting in a cafe chatting about how we simply didn't see ourselves reflected in the media or pop culture. We didn't see ourselves reflected as Muslim women, all of our diverse stories. For example, I'd read yet another article on sort of arranged marriages and matchmaking, which crop up quite often in the media. But that's not how I met my partner. That's not how many of my girlfriends met their partners. And I started thinking, why not ask Muslim women to talk about all of the ways that they are finding love or searching for love?
What was that narrative that you did not relate to, the matchmaking thing? Was it basically arranged marriage? Is that what you mean?
Sure. And that's definitely one truth. But it's not the only story out there. And I felt that because of that strict focus only on that one story, we're actually not hearing this wide diversity of really exciting and nuanced other stories that are out there. And so we decided to ask Muslim women to tell us their stories. A lot has been written about us as Muslim women, but very little of it has been written by Muslim women ourselves.
And what did you feel was missing up to that point? Like, what was the spark that was like, you know, we have to do this, and now is the time?
I think we, first of all, were just tired of not seeing ourselves reflected. And then we thought, what's the best way for people to really connect to Muslim women who are often so otherized? And we thought, the search for love stories. You know, Jane Austen, for example, continues to have this resonance hundreds of years after those stories were written. And everyone loves a good love story. And yet love as a quality, as an emotion, is not something that's often ascribed, attributed to Muslims or Islam. And yet it's integral to us as humans, and it's integral to Islam as a religion. And we really wanted to share that tradition and that reality.
And so you set out, you had this idea, and then what was next? Next was finding the stories, right?
Absolutely. And so we actually ended up doing two call for stories, national calls for stories, one in 2008 and one in 2011. And we initially sent it out on listservs, professional and personal networks, sort of just tried to put the word out as far as we could. The second time around, we used Facebook and Twitter quite a bit as well, as they'd sort of come into their own as social networks. And we started receiving dozens of responses, and eventually over 200 stories came in. And then Noora and I went through a process of sort of distilling that, looking for literary quality, and then really trying to balance balance between the immense diversity along racial and ethnic lines.
So you were getting stories from who?
From women of all ages, between their 20s to their 60s, women who were single, married, divorced, widowed, women from pretty much every ethnic and racial background you can imagine, women who were born Muslim as well as converted to Islam along the way, all over the U.S., small towns, big cities. It really reflected not only the diversity of the U.S., but this immense diversity that's within the American Muslim community, which is actually the most diverse Muslim community in the world.
And so despite this diversity, did you feel there were some common threads?
Yeah, we've actually grouped our stories into five sections. So there's sort of the traditional meets the 21st century dating and online type of new ways of courtship and dating and finding a partner, as well as sort of this how do you balance community? How do you balance family? How do you balance that with your own desires for romance and finding a partner? So there are definitely threads. But what we also found was that each voice and the 25 women here and the hundreds who wrote into us were absolutely unique in their search for love as well, even when there were common themes like how to balance, family and your own desires for finding a partner and what you're looking for. Or there's a whole section on women going abroad and meeting this stranger and wondering, well, should I move forward? What can happen here? So it's, I think it's something that everyone can relate to. You know, we, as Americans, we relate to the different ideas of love that are presented here. And then there's also a unique twist, a Muslim twist on it that I think American Muslims and Muslims around the world can really relate to as well.
So how much of this project for you is telling the stories of American Muslim women through love and sexuality? And how much of it is, I have a stereotype I need to break?
Well, it's absolutely about amplifying Muslim women's voices and giving them a stage to decide what is the story that you want to share. But yeah, secondarily, it's definitely about smashing stereotypes. And those stereotypes exist both in our wider American community of people who are from all faiths and backgrounds. And those stereotypes also exist within the Muslim community. And we really wanted to challenge both of them by presenting women who identify as Orthodox, secular, cultural Muslims. We felt it was very important to have that entire stage presented, because often it's only the extremes that are presented in media or pop culture, for example. So we really wanted to have that richness and that diversity and the conflict and complexity and messiness of sort of our everyday lives and relationships presented here. And we've had amazing feedback. Women and men from all different backgrounds and faiths have told us that they, for the first time, have seen themselves reflected in the lives of Muslim women, and that is something that was completely unexpected to them.
Zahra Noor Bakhsh is one of the contributors. So, Zahra, how did you hear about the project, and what made you want to be a contributor? What kind of conversation were you having with yourself?
I have many conversations with myself, and on this particular occasion, I was particularly excited by the breadth of stories. I felt that within the 25 stories that were in the book, there were stories that directly contradicted each other in their idea of Islamic practice and in their idea of love and the search for love. And that really is what intrigued me most. That was what I felt like, was a kind of collection that could break these stereotypes and really deepen the conversation and build on the complexity about Muslim women.
Was it a struggle for you, the decision to say, okay, I am going to share my very personal story with the world?
It took me about 3 seconds.
3 seconds.
1, 2, 3, yes.
So it seems to me like it was just inside of you and waiting to just burst out if it just took you 33 seconds to make
absolutely.
That decision.
I'm a comedian. I'm a Muslim Iranian-American feminist comedian. And I have many worlds to
and
integrate.
And yes, you can be all those things.
Yes, you can be all those things. And so for me, you know, I'm always looking for opportunities to be able to share my perspective, you know. It's a unique perspective and one that I think needs to be a part of the conversation. So I was very excited to be on board.
I was very excited to read your segment as well, your portion, your story. And I asked you that question because it was a funny part of the book. It was very, very personal. And I'm wondering if you could like share with us a passage.
Absolutely.
From your story. And it has to do with a hole.
It does. My story is called The Birds, the Bees, and My Hole. It's about my awkward sex talk with my mother when I was just 14 years old. That seems a little late for some people. I thought I had it all together, but my mother taught me that no, in fact, there were elements I was not aware of. So I'm going to read a quick passage where I'm in the car with my mother before I go to the movies with my friends.
Like in Danville, just like right
here. This is in Danville, yeah. This is in Danville, California, where I grew up. My mother had a distant look in her eyes, but then suddenly zeroed in on me with intense concentration. Zahra, you have a hole. And for the rest of your life, men will want to put their penis in your hole. It doesn't matter who you are, what you look like, who is your friend. Even at the movies, Mamanjan, wherever, it does not change. Ryan seems like a very nice man, but he is a man. And all he wants is your hole. So I will pick you up here at 5 o'clock. Have fun, Mamanjan, she said.
And your reaction was?
I was horrified. I was horrified. I was like, oh my good God, you're right. I absolutely cannot go to the movies. I have a hole. Did you know about this? Did you know there is a hole? And, you know, so many of my friends made fun of me that you know, this was something that I didn't know. But I really thought I had a clear idea of what happened between the sheets. And my mother kind of blew my mind that day.
So, I mean, do you feel that, like, through all these stories that you're telling in your book, do you feel that there's not an elder, but like a parent generation of either first generation immigrants who came from other parts of the world, from Muslim countries, and then there's their children, and then there's a struggle between these two cultures that happens with any immigrant population. But do you feel like that these conversations about love and sexuality are starting to happen, at least, between kind of the immigrant moms and dads and their children?
Absolutely. I mean, there are definitely people who identify as second generation in here, but there are also women who come from families who have been here for centuries. So people who are very embedded and do not have that sort of immigrant narrative. But for those who do have that immigrant narrative, I think, yeah, coming from more traditional backgrounds, sometimes that can be a bit of an awkward talk, as Zahra's story shows. But in other cases, what's really beautiful about many of these stories is parents who are willing to engage in that conversation, who show unexpected flexibility or understanding, particularly for many of the fathers in this collection. We've actually been told repeatedly that people found those to be some of the most tender portrayals, that Muslim men have sometimes even a more stereotyped image than Muslim women do, an even narrower definition that sort of puts them in an angry sort of stereotype. And so to see that sort of tenderness with their daughters, that sort of flexibility that's apparent in Zahra's story, my story, Leila Khan, many of the other stories, the fathers who are willing to sort of sit down and chat with their daughters about maybe someone they wouldn't have really approved of their daughters being with, and yet they were willing to engage in that conversation, continue the relationship. And that's actually been quite beautiful for us to read as editors and for our readers to connect to as well.
Right. And I'm going to ask the audience to give us a call with your questions or comments or whatever you're thinking about right now. If you're in your car, wherever you are, you know you're kind of thinking about this issue. Give us a call, 800-798-TALK. Or if you're listening to us on KALW.org, you can send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. What's your story of reconciling where your religious beliefs with who you are, with what you think? Let us know right now at 866-798-TALK. And Aisha, I want to go now to your part, your passage, if you can share with us a little bit of what you wrote for Love Inshallah.
So, yeah, just to give a little bit of background, I'm speaking with my father who's in Pakistan, and I've just told him that I met a boy. And I've never spoken to my father about any guy before. And I've told him that we want to get married, and he is non-Muslim. No one in my family has ever married a non-Pakistani or considered someone who was not born Muslim. What a long way my father and I have come from the night we sat on the porch a decade ago, and he told me I had to marry someone who was not only Pakistani, but of the same clan and caste as ours. I know that both of my younger sisters being spoken for makes it easier for him to bend, as does the looming threat of my spinsterhood. But I am humbled by my father's love, by his willingness to consider and make room for his daughter's happiness, in spite of the censure he and my mother will face from some of their friends and family members. I think that goes back to that whole idea of families are sort of unfolding relationships over time and lifetimes, and where my parents were at 10 years before I met my husband was at a very different place from when we finally had that conversation about someone who wasn't Pakistani, who wasn't Muslim, and how to integrate that, how to sort of bend for your daughter's happiness.
And so you call him your husband, so that story ended well?
Yes, it ended very well.
It ended well.
10 years later, still together.
Oh, that's great. You mentioned that you've gotten some great feedback. And so I'm wondering if you had gotten any negative feedback, specifically kind of from within the American Muslim community at all.
Sure. Overwhelmingly, it has been positive, but we have received the minority opinion has sort of been this is not an Islamic book. And Noura and I were very clear that you're right, this is not an Islamic book. And we actually talk about that in our introduction, that this is not a theological treatise, it's not a dating manual, it's not a code of conduct, it's the lived realities of Muslim women. So we have received some of that. There's also been, there have been some people who have not been comfortable with some of the stories, especially around homosexuality and premarital sex. They're not perhaps certain that those are issues that really should be broached or talked about openly.
And those are considered taboo in many cultures.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. And but on the other hand, from very orthodox segments of the community, we've also received incredible support. We've been on orthodox radio shows, magazines, websites. We've had interviews. People have been very supportive, saying these issues are real, they need to be lifted up, and we need to be addressing them more openly and directly.
Nobody's asked you to repent?
Not yet.
Okay.
Unless you're going to do that.
So not likely.
Okay.
Not likely. Full disclosure, I am a Muslim woman, and I met my husband online. There, I've said it to the world. And have you heard from people who are from other non-Muslim traditions, you know, to whom these stories still speak and resonate? On your blog, you recently linked to an article by Avital Chizhik, an Orthodox Jewish woman, about her questions around dating and marriage. And so I'm wondering kind of what do you see as the similarities? If you want to go for that, Zahra, or
yeah, Aisha? I mean, so many similarities in terms of wanting to, you know, as you put, reconcile your sexuality with piety, definitely comes up
And those often are not in the same sentence.
Right.
Anywhere.
Exactly.
Right.
Anywhere. I think that's also what's important and was what was so great about that article is that, you know, we don't often hear that conversation talked about in this, you know, those topics talked about in the same sentence. And yet I feel like there's this magnifying glass and sometimes microscope on Islam and on it as a single form of practice. And we don't have, you know, many nuanced conversations about different ways of practicing Islam. And so it was nice to see that article shared on the Love Inshallah blog as well.
Well, our number is 866-798-TALK. If you'd like to give us a call and speak to the ladies of Love Inshallah, the secret love lives of American Muslim women. With me is Aisha Matu and Zahra Noor Bakhsh. Zahra is a contributor and Aisha is a co-editor. So let's go to our first caller today. Let's go to Eve in Sokol. Hi, Eve.
Hello. I'm calling about the French ban on headscarves. And I'm not a religious person in any way, but I would not want anyone telling me that I couldn't wear a headscarf if it was sacred to me. And I got very upset about that decision. And I'm wondering if you guys could comment on that, if you would.
Okay, thank you, Eve. Anybody? Zahra?
I was just thinking, I suppose, yes, even the French, I would not be comfortable telling me how to fashion it up. Surprising, but I thought I'd be down with the French view on fashion. But in this instance, I was kind of horrified.
Yeah, I just feel like whether it's the French telling you to take it off or the Iranians telling you to put it on, no one should be telling women how to dress.
Or the Turks not letting you in the university with your hijab.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So I'm wondering also the significance of the title, Love, Inshallah. If you can explain to our listeners kind of what Inshallah is.
Sure. Inshallah means God willing, and it's a term that's used very widely among Muslims regardless of religious practice. We wanted it to be hopeful, a hopeful and romantic title. Love, Inshallah, it sort of says everything in our life sort of unfolds with the will of God and that hopefulness that's within there that we'll be able to achieve that love in our lives. And then the subtitle, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women, actually stirred up more controversy than we'd initially thought it would.
Secret love lives.
Right. And secret on many levels. These are stories that were not being talked about within the Muslim community, and they certainly had not even been heard within the wider community. And it's a great title that sort of pulls you in, and it's provocative. The cover itself is provocative. We went for negligee instead of a veil because we feel like the veil's really been done, overdone.
On the cover.
Yes.
Right.
So, and it's also metaphorical. It's really about these women are taking us to a place of extreme vulnerability and intimacy, or being invited into the bedroom, really, to have a heart-to-heart chat over a cup of tea.
Ah, lovely. Well, again, with me is Aisha Matu and Zahra Noor Bakhsh from Love Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women, the book. We are still taking your calls at 866-798-TALK. And the question is, you know, now that you've heard their stories, what are yours? You know, if you grew up in any strict tradition, cultural or religious, what were your challenges in kind of reconciling your personal life with your family or community? You know, some people had to leave that community or leave the family. For some people, the parents were understanding. So give us a call or drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
And I think your question earlier was so interesting as well.
And we can get to that right after the break. This is Your Call on KALW.
Call on Local Public Radio KALW, a program that relies on engaged listeners, and we invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you will also find links related to today's show. And that's where you can sign up for the weekly email newsletter as well. It's at kalw.org.
Welcome back to Your Call on KALW 91.7. I'm Hanat Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today. And today we're speaking with the co-author and contributor of the book Love Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women. With me is Aisha Matu, the co-author, and Zahra Noorbakhsh, a contributor to the book. And today we're talking about this book where 25 Muslim women in America shared their stories of reconciling who they are with where they came from. And we are taking your calls at 866-798-TALK, or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org and tell us what are your stories of reconciling tradition, your cultural tradition or your religious tradition with who you are and your personal life. 866-798-TALK. Aisha, before the break, we were kind of talking about other communities that might share what American Muslim women have gone through, and that have you heard some of those stories?
Yeah, absolutely. We've had a lot of women from Jewish and Catholic communities particularly say they really understand and relate to these stories. We've also had Sikh women say the same thing. In fact, there's going to be a collection of Sikh women's stories that's inspired by this collection. There's a call for stories that is going out and collecting stories about love of all sort of things, like love of travel, love of children, love of God, the search for a partner, and others. It's just really been beautiful to see people, again, seeing themselves reflected in Muslim women's lives. And we had this woman write into us from Cambridge, Mass. And she said, you know, after reading this anthology, I was driving down the street and I saw two women in a niqab, wearing niqab, the face veil. And I realized that I had never seen them as women until I read this anthology. I'd always seen them as other. And so it's not that it's some sort of like nefarious intent. This is a woman from one of the most progressive cities in the nation. And yet she still had ideas that she couldn't, you know, relate to these women. And yet by reading this, they were revealed in all of their humanity. And she was able to make that heart-to-heart connection beyond the political headlines. Mm-hmm. And that was wonderful for us to hear.
Is that one of the goals of your book?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's a political conversation, but we often get stuck in that conversation. And I think there are so many other conversations, dialogue, connection points for us to be having
that aren't getting that much
exactly,
attention.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so this book is definitely one of the ways to have other conversations that are just as important, if not more so.
Okay, we're going to go to another caller. We're going to go talk to Philip in Oakland. Hi, Philip.
Hi. Thanks for this program. I think it's a really important topic because, as you mentioned briefly, the constant parade of immigrant groups coming to the United States for decades and decades has gone through this process where the second generation has changed from their parents and ancestors and has been affected by the liberality of the society in the West in general, in contrast to other cultures, and includes Catholics and Jews and Hindus, and so almost every group, I think. And that's why it's extremely relevant. But I have a question, and that is, I know that contraception, it must be controversial. I'd like to know how that's handled and what are the ranges of behaviors in that regard.
Okay, thanks, Philip. Anybody want to take that? Aisha, Zahra, contraception.
I mostly have inappropriate behaviors around that. But, you know, it's definitely a struggle and a conversation. Mm. But more so outside of my religion and directly with frustrations with birth control itself. Mm-hmm. And its mania. But
it's need to be covered by health insurance.
It's interesting to me how topics like this around Islam are always within the scope of the religion. that oftentimes when we think of, you know, Christianity or Judaism, we understand spirituality as being a part of rather than the entirety of a person's identity. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to me that conversations around it are solely within the scope of the religion itself.
Mm-hmm. I think that's also because of kind of the anti-contraceptive movement that kind of stems from Catholicism, maybe, that people are asking about Islam and Muslim women. Do they have the same struggle with contraception or not? What have you been hearing?
I think the simple answer is there's a range of opinions, depending on who you speak with. Even very orthodox opinions range from it's not permissible to, yes, of course it's permissible to space your children out and all of that, or to choose not to have them or whatever the couple decides. Most of that, the traditional outlook is definitely within a marital context, and Islam is actually extremely pro-sex within a marital context.
Extremely.
I was listening to an Orthodox radio show.
Extremely.
I was listening to an Orthodox radio show from Southern California.
When you say Orthodox, you mean Orthodox Muslim?
Yes, Orthodox mm-hmm. Muslim. Traditional, conservative, there's a range of terms that could be used. And they were speaking so beautifully and openly about the use of erotica between husbands and wives and a way to sort of keep that flame going over decades of marriage. So there's just some really wonderful conversations happening out there. I don't think it's just one perspective. Like Zahra said, there's a range, and we have to start acknowledging that that range exists.
And that range does include being gay. So mm-hmm. I'm going to read a little bit from another contributor, Tolu Adiba. She writes, here it is. Yes. She wrote, I was drawn to Islam's simplicity. She's a convert. I set out on a path, like so many lesbians and gays, trying to reconcile my faith and my sexuality, both of which I believed stemmed from God. But I lived in a state of fear, careful not to react externally to the harsh rhetoric I heard from imams and Muslim friends about gays while cringing internally. So I'm wondering how do both of you see Muslim men and women coming out of the closet within Islam? It's a shared conflict, again, within Catholicism and Judaism and even like a non-religious institution like the U.S. military. And it's still a conflict kind of in American society with gay marriage bans and the like. So within the Muslim woman context, what is that struggle like?
So for one thing, her pen name is Tolu Adiba, but she recently came out. So Ife Okoye has started the process of sort of coming out and speaking about her story.
She's using her real name
now. She's using her real name. So she just recently came out. And, you know, it's her story is actually one of my favorites in the collection because she's willing to sort of talk about these issues that are sort of messy, and they're not easy to neatly tie off and reconcile necessarily. And she's okay with leaving things open-ended and continuing her journey.
She doesn't have a solution.
Exactly.
Per se.
It's a journey rather than a solution or, you know, sort of, I have reached the end point either by coming out or by writing the story. It's an ongoing journey for her, and I really appreciate and respect that. And yeah, I think that, again, we're going to see a range. Suhaib Webb, who's a considered sort of a more traditional imam out in Boston, recently came out with...
Was here in the Bay Area, in Santa Clara.
Yes, but is now on the East Coast in Roxbury. And he recently came out saying gay Muslims should be welcome in the mosque. And, you know, that may or may not sound revolutionary to you, depending on, you know, where someone's at politically. But for many Muslims, that was... that was taking quite a strong stand, because for many years the conversation has been you cannot be gay and Muslim at the same time. So what he was saying was he was acknowledging that gay Muslims exist. It, you know, it's something that we have to accept, and that no one should be barred from coming to the mosque and praying and being a part of the community. And so I think that's starting a whole new dialogue, one that's extremely necessary. And I think Afi's story has also been one that has really resonated with a lot of our traditional readers, because I think they always looked at gay or lesbian Muslims as out there, as secular, as attacking Islam, or not considering themselves as Muslim, perhaps. And her story was saying, I go to the mosque, I pray, I consider myself to be traditional Orthodox, to have studied it. I met my partner at the mosque, and that I'm not the only one. And so it has started a whole new conversation that has been wonderful. And so many people from the more traditional perspective have actually said that is one of the stories that they actually identified with the most strongly in this collection.
Another kind of seemingly contradictory connection also is kind of feminism and feminist Muslim. And I read somewhere on some blog, and I won't name it, you know, it's an oxymoron. What is a feminist Muslim woman? How can you be a Muslim woman and be feminist? And you have a story in the book about a woman, Patricia Dunn, who considers herself a radical political feminist, and she converts to Islam because of a man she falls in love with. And Zahra, you said, you know, I'm a Muslim woman and I'm a feminist. How do you think modern feminism coexists with being a Muslim and Islam?
I think it's actually even harder to reconcile both those identities with my identity as a comedian. Muslims and feminists apparently can't take a joke, and so that's certainly a struggle in my career. It's interesting to me. I find it, incredibly offensive, you know, when people say that you can't be Muslim and be feminist, you know, because you can be a lot of different identities that, you know, don't necessarily have anything to do with one another. There are people who are Muslim that I don't consider feminists, and there are people who are Muslim that I consider being on the front lines of feminism and discussions around fourth wave feminism. So there, I just pulled that out. Mm. Fourth wave feminism. Now you know how smart I am.
But you don't feel a conflict sometimes between kind of feminist ideals and the feminist way and then that verse or in Quran or, you know, or might someone pull out a verse and say, you know, here, you cannot be a feminist because they, you know, ascribe to this, this and that, and you can't be that because you're Muslim. What kind of conversations have you had with people?
I mean, I feel that, you know, a part of any kind of ideology is contradiction. And having to compromise those contradictions is a battle regardless of the ideology. For instance, my feminism comes into direct conflict with my boyfriend on a daily basis.
How so?
The dishes. Guess what? If they don't get done, it's not my job. And when he leaves them there, he thinks, I know in the back of his mind, that it is my job. And that's pretty old school relationship talk,
right.
You know, and pretty backward for my feminist ways that actually has nothing to do with a conversation around religion.
Right, right. Okay, we're going to take another caller. She's calling us from work, so we'll get you on now. Moira in San Francisco. Hi.
Hi, yes. I'm calling up because I was born and raised Catholic and was practicing until about a couple of months ago, and I came out as being bisexual about 3 years ago and was trying to reconcile the two for a very long time. But now I've begun working on entering the Episcopal Church, where I feel so much more accepted for my whole self as being a woman and being bisexual, and it's been a wonderful experience for me.
Oh, well, that's great, Moira. And can you guys relate to that? Is there kind of the same thing between Sunni Muslims and Shia Muslims? And like Sufism is seen as kind of more into the loving, inspirational aspect. Is there a sect of Islam that seems to be more relationship friendly or like love friendly, if that's the case?
I think any community that's plugged into the names of God is going to reflect the attribute of Al-Wadud, the loving. You know, that's one of the names of God in the Islamic tradition. So that's what we aspire to as a community, I think, regardless of our affiliation as secular, Orthodox, cultural Muslims. But speaking more directly to her question and experience, there definitely is space within the community for a variety of experiences and journeys. And, for example, there are a number of progressive Muslim communities where gay Muslims are very much an active part of the community, are welcomed, and women are also encouraged to take on leadership roles, are encouraged to lead prayers. So there's definitely that range, again, that spectrum of practice, spectrum of willingness to engage in debates, to welcome people of different thoughts and lifestyles. And that's definitely happening. And as I mentioned earlier, Sohaib Webb, who's, you know, more traditionalist.
Pretty prominent as
yes,
well.
Yes, very prominent
people
traditionalist.
To him.
So he's having a conversation that might be a bit different. Perhaps he's not saying, you know, people should act upon certain things, but he's still saying people should be welcome. So that's happening at one end. And on the other end, people are saying, you are welcome, come, join, speak, be active, be engaged, be a leader. So there's a very wide dialogue and conversation happening in the Muslim community right now in America.
So your book is focusing on American Muslim women. Mm-hmm. Have you heard any feedback from European Muslim women or Muslim women from the Muslim countries? What kind of reactions have you gotten? Have you gotten the reaction of, oh, those Americans?
Not so much.
Those liberal Americans, even their Islam is liberal.
Right, right. Well, we've heard a little bit about California because Nora and I were based in California at the time. I'm still here. She's in Chicago now. So a number of our connections are sort of California focused. So people said, oh, it's the California brand of Islam. So there's a little bit of that. But as we said, we try to keep a real diversity and include and be very inclusive of a range of voices. You know, we have traditional arranged marriages and this, and then we have, you know, sort of meeting someone in college and dating them. So a very wide range. But we've had a lot of interest from the Middle East, from South Asia, from Europe. A number of magazines and newspapers and TV shows have covered the book. Indonesia, which is the most populous Muslim nation in the world, is the first one to have bought the book to be translated and published next year, inshallah. And so we're really, really excited that the first publisher to pick it up abroad is a Muslim publisher from a prominent Muslim country. And I think that really reflects their hope that this is really going to connect with their readership, because it is reflecting a universal position or experiences of Muslim women. Sure, there are some things that might be particularly American, but there are other things that are universal and human and that everyone is going to be able to see themselves in. What we actually hope in future, we'd love for this to be translated in many different languages, but we'd really like to see indigenous editions come out. We want to see Love Inshallah, England and South Africa and Malaysia. We want women in those countries and editors in those countries to tell their stories and to tell us their priorities and their range of experiences. Maybe it'll look very similar. Maybe it'll look quite different depending on, you know, ethnicity, socioeconomic factors, many other factors that are present.
Maybe an event.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So we'd be very excited if that happened.
Our number, if you'd like to give us a call and talk to Aisha Matu and Zahra Nurbakhsh, our number is 866-798-TALK, or you can send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Aisha, your personal story starts after the events of 9/11, and it seems hard to talk about Muslims in America these days without bringing up 9/11. But how did that time further complicate what it meant to be a Muslim and to kind of pursue that relationship that you talked about that went very well?
I sort of drifted away from the practice that I was raised with, which was fairly dogmatic. And when I went to college, then I sort of decided not to practice anymore because it the roots weren't deep enough to answer the questions that I had.
Your family was back home, back in Pakistan?
Yes, they were in Pakistan at that time. And I was raised partially here in California as well. So I went to college on the East Coast, and that's sort of where I was at for a while. And then I discovered the mystic poets of Islam, Rumi and Rabi'a al-Adawiyya and Hafiz, and so many others who speak to this, a strict orthodoxy in many ways in terms of their practice of Islam, but also imbued with such beauty and love and longing.
Which you hadn't heard before in connection with Islam?
Which I had heard, but not seen practiced very well, perhaps. And not deeply focused upon, not a daily practice in words and speech and behavior. So here it was, I started reading, I started sort of going on this road back to practice and to Islam and finding a space for that in my life. And then 9/11 happened. And instead of pushing me away, it actually brought me closer. It made me want to dive even more deeply and to find that space, because I knew that beauty existed, and I wanted that in my life, and I wanted to share that with others. And that's when I also bumped into the man who would become my husband. And then sort of, I never doubted my Americanness and my Muslimness. 9/11 only underlined how deeply I felt at home in both identities. And that those were reconciled, complex, but reconciled. And the interesting thing about the book is seeing how many women had a similar experience. Mm-hmm. That, yes, they see their identities as complex and multifaceted, but not necessarily as conflicting or mutually exclusive. And I think that's a very important point to raise.
You seem to be a strong woman, but on some level, did it comfort you to read about all these other women that are just like me?
Absolutely. It's been amazing. Noura and I think, also came into this thinking we knew who the Muslim community was because we're Muslim. And then I realized, well, actually, it's such an amazing broad spectrum, and it has really deepened my own commitment to amplifying women's voices, their stories, to encouraging that dialogue, especially between generations, especially as the mother to a young son.
Okay, let's go to another caller. Let's go to Paul in Santa Cruz. Hi, Paul.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for calling.
Great show. A couple of things I wanted to contribute, if I might.
Sure.
First, it's fascinating to me, being an older man who's gone through a lot of transformation, to see how the relationships between men and women sexually really reflect the relationships between human beings from, you know, various attitudes, cultures, religions, in terms of how tolerance or intolerance expresses itself. And I became a feminist as a man after I read some very important books, and I wanted to share those with you. The books were shared with me by a woman who was a feminist lesbian of Middle Eastern descent who became my friend because I was a good ear. She normally didn't talk to men, but she and I became friends because we worked together. And she recommended that I read Andrea Dworkin's Woman Hating and Susan Brown Miller's Against Our Will. And it really opened up my eyes to how women are objectified and how men, you know, have treated women historically. And I was able to become a better friend, a better partner, and even a better husband because I read those books and understood historically the sweep of how women were objectified and treated. So I really recommend those strongly to anyone who wants to open up to see how the relationships need to change.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for that call, Paul, the feminist man. And I'd like to read an email as well that came in from Lulu. And he or she, I'm thinking it's a she, says, I'm curious if there are certain traditional values or values which come from Islam, which are strongly held onto as a whole by the Muslim women you interviewed.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Paul's question as well also reminded me of this, was that throughout the book you see strong themes of families, the importance of family, being connected to them, to dialogue with them, to a lifelong relationship with them. It's very integral and important support. I was at a book club reading recently in San Francisco. We do Skype or in-person visits for book clubs who select the book, and they said, you know, after reading this book, we realized that if I say you're a good Muslim, it's one of the highest compliments I can give, because they learned the Islamic values of social justice, of service, civil service, caring and compassion. All of these things are so deeply embedded in the religion, and they saw that sort of played out in these women's lives, and that was a way for them to connect to a lived philosophy of Islam in these women's lives. And I thought that was just beautiful, and it was very moving for me to hear people who were from other faiths and backgrounds say that.
Well, we're almost out of time. Where can they see you? You're at Lit Quake.
We're at Lit Quake on October 13th at 8:30 p.m. Yep.
And what?
We're at Lit Quake and at Lit Crawl.
Right. So October 13th, 8:30 p.m., Modern Times Bookstore. We'll be doing a reading. About five of us from the book will be together. Zahra and I will be there.
And I'll also be at Z Space on October 6th, performing with four funny women in a program called Verbal Calisthenics.
Okay.
All the information is available at litquake.org.
Or loveinshallah.com.
Either one. Any final thoughts on kind of what you want this anthology to do, really quickly, though?
I would love this anthology to continue being a source of companionship for women who are in a position like me as well, who have a religious Muslim identity and are looking for the similar search for love alongside a diverse view of the Muslim experience as a woman.
Excellent. And we'll leave it there. That's a great way to end the show with. We've been speaking with Aisha Matu, co-author of Love Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women, and Zahra Nurbakhsh, contributor to the book. We'll put a link to web resources at our new website, yourcallradio.org. It's also where you can post your comments and continue this conversation. Don't stop sending those emails. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for your calls and emails. Sorry we couldn't get to all of them. I'm Hanat Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. And here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the 67th session of the United Nations General Assembly. How did media cover the speeches and the protests outside the UN? We'll also discuss fracking in North Dakota and the oil boom in Montana. And where did you see the best reporting this week? Join us live at 10 or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP and Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.